Hello, everyone. Hopefully you guys can hear me. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Brad Smoyer, and I'm an account executive here at PCI Pharma Services. I'm joined by David O'Connell, PCI's Director of Scientific Affairs, Gareth Phillips, PCI's Senior Development Scientist and International Potent Compound Safety Expert, Dean Calhoun, who is the CEO of Affagility Solutions. The discussion topic today, we will address the best practices when setting health-based cleaning limits in a multi-product CDMO facility. Before we get started, I just have a few housekeeping items to mention. Please ensure you are muted for the duration of the session so that we can all hear our speakers. This is an informal chat, and we welcome and encourage your questions. So if you have any questions, please enter it into the chat function located on your toolbar. And if you're not able to access the chat, you can send your questions via WhatsApp to phone number +44 0 7964 432 523. And I'll say that number again so you can take it down. That's +44 0 7964 432 523. And with that, David, Gareth, and Dean, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Brad. So I'm just going to give a little bit of background into the main topics that we're going to be discussing today. So, yeah, welcome to our water cooler chat. So the first question I would ask is, why do we need to clean pharmaceutical processing equipment? So simply, the cleaning of GMP equipment is to ensure that there's no cross-contamination or even potentially harmful carryover to the next product or to a different dose strength. When the drug products are produced in multi-API facilities, there's an even greater risk of cross-contamination. So in June 2015, the EMA implemented a guideline on setting health-based exposure limits. This was a risk-based approach in conjunction with ICH Q9 and ICH Q10. Prior to this guidance being implemented, the more traditional way of cleaning GMP processing equipment was to use the 1/1000th method, or 10 ppm, where acceptable residue limits of 1/1000th of the lowest clinical dose were used to ensure there's suitable cleanliness between products. However, regulators stated that the approach did not take into account available pharmacological and toxicological data, and it also didn't take into account the duration of the exposure. So basically, it was a very unreliable method, which wasn't very scientific, and over or underestimated the chronic dose that was safe for patients. So back to the EMA guidance document, where health-based exposure limits are used to denote a safe threshold value based on risks identified. These values are termed either PDE or ADE. So PDE is permitted daily exposure, or acceptable daily exposure for ADE. And this is really dependent on your regulatory geography, but essentially they're the same thing and they're interchangeable terms. PDE and ADE values should be derived from evaluation of available pharmacological and toxicological data, including both preclinical and, if possible, at the available point in the drug product life cycle, any clinical data as well. The PDE calculation is based on Appendix 3 of ICH Q3R4 guidance for residual solvents, and there's also a similar veterinary guidance document also. So once PDEs and ADEs are established, the question is, what do we do with them? So they're utilized to prepare maximum carryover limits, which can be used within sensitive analytical methodology during the cleaning assessments. An assessment is made on specific equipment train chosen for the product with relation to the proposed batch size and maximum daily dose. But Gareth, we'll go into more depth about this topic. And the equipment train is only the equipment parts which are in direct contact with the drug product and wish to be used on other products, for example, granulation bowls to encapsulation format parts or through to sample sleeves, normally the most expensive parts which can't be dedicated. The actual dedicated and disposable parts are not considered. So I'd like to now turn the discussion over to Dean, who's going to discuss in more depth the ADEPD calculation concept. Over to you, Dean.
All right, thank you, Dave. Well, as Dave mentioned, the EMA guideline went into effect back in June of 2015. While this seems like a fairly new approach to a lot of companies, the fact of the matter is many of the big pharma companies have been establishing PDEs for their companies probably at least 10 years prior to the EMA guideline. And also, I'd like to emphasize, as Dave mentioned, the term PDE, ADE, and you may also see HBEL, which stands for health-based exposure limit. Those are all the same thing. They mean all the same thing. And if you look at the calculations for ADE and PDE, while they look a little slightly different, if you go to the EMA guideline, and I believe it's on page 11, footnote 4, it's buried down in this really tiny text. It says that ADE and PDE are effectively synonymous. And if you also go to the PICS guidelines, which pretty much mirrored the EMA's guideline, the PICS guideline says the same thing. So it's important to know that ADE, PDE, and HBEL are essentially all the same thing. Toxicologists love acronyms. So we have to deal with thousands of acronyms a day. And some of them are acronyms made up of other acronyms. So, it gets really complicated at times. So what is the process of establishing ADEs? Well, in my mind, establishing an ADE is essentially a data problem. While the calculation looks fairly simple, if you go to the calculation, you could probably do the math in your head. Some people can do that in their head. The calculation is very simple, but it's the interpretation of the data that goes into the calculation that is critical. You know, when they first came out with the EMA guideline, a lot of people thought, oh, this will be fine. I'll just create some Excel spreadsheet and I'll create ADEs and PDEs all day long. Well, it doesn't work that way. Well, for several reasons. So the first thing you want to do when you calculate an ADE is collect the data. And now people ask, well, what kind of data do you need? Well, give us all the data that you have. In general, we don't need the raw data, but well-summarized data from all the relevant studies is helpful. We want acute studies, but things like LD50s are worthless. In fact, the EMA in their Q&A that they issued a couple years after the EMA guideline came out, they said that a LD50 is not an acceptable point of departure. Well, this other society just came out with a guide, I think it was the API Society recently, that started you talking about LD50 and how to derive a ADE by use of an LD50. Well, that's not going to be compliant with the EMA or PICS guidelines, so I don't even know why they did that. So we typically want maximum tolerated dose studies don't do us much good either. We don't care how much a person can survive taking. We want the very, very low part on the dose response curve, and I'll talk more about that in a second. We generally like multi-dose studies, typically 28 days or longer. And then another critical part is some information about genotoxicity assays. So if you have an Ames test or maybe in silico assessments such as, you know, multi-case, we typically use multi-case or Derek, there's several of them out there. Just as long as you have an in silico assessment, that'll help us out. And we also want PK data such as elimination half-life and bioavailability. So once we got all the data in front of us, we review all the data and we determine what is called the point of departure. In very general terms, the point of departure is the very low end of the left-hand side of the dose response curve. So it's where that kick, where the knee in the curve is, essentially, where it just starts to go upwards. And that point of departure, again, in very general terms, is the point where you can't tell the difference between an exposed animal or human or a non-exposed animal or human. So once you select the point of departure, then you start dividing by a series of adjustment factors. These adjustment factors can include human variability. It can include interspecies variability, such if that POD is from rat data, then you have to apply a adjustment factor going from rat to human. And then, severity and some other factors, maybe for reproductive toxicity. And then there could be a modifying factor for missing data. And this typically happens when you have early stage compounds. You're probably not going to have carcinogenicity studies or reproductive toxicology studies. So we understand that, but we'll account for that. So we also apply, where relevant, a PK factor. So when we're all done, we end up with the maximum dose that a person can receive day after day with no effect. And again, it's day after day by any route. Could be IV, could be inhalation, could be oral, by any route with no effect. Now, we can create ADEs that are route specific, and that may help you out in your process. But again, the definition of the ADE is by any route. So those adjustment factors that I talked about, this is where experience and expertise comes in. Here at Afagility Solutions, we look at hundreds of monographs per year. And many of, I hate to say, but many of them are done really poorly. And the ones that are done really poorly is because people are not confident in their toxicology abilities. So they just start throwing in uncertainty factors of 10 or adjustment factors of 10. Well, if you have four adjustment factors of 10, your total composite adjustment factor is 10,000. The EPA and other organizations have said that if you have a composite adjustment factor greater than 10,000, you don't know much about your compound. So that's where a lot of people make mistakes. So what they end up doing is driving their ADE value down so low that you really, really need expensive and sophisticated analytical methods to get down that low. So, you know, once the document and all the data is put together and authored and compiled, here at Afagility, we always have it go through a peer review process to make sure we didn't miss something. And so that takes time. And then after that's done, we have it go through a very extensive quality control process. While this seems easy and the EMA guideline looks fairly simple, there's actually a lot of stuff that people don't read in that guideline that are very important. Because if you look at that equation that's in the EMA guideline, it says NOEL, no observable effect level. And people think they have to have a NOEL. Well, your point of departure might not be, a NOEL might not be the best point of departure, because sometimes you'll have adverse health effects in humans at the lowest therapeutic dose. you know, oncology products are a perfect example. You know, you could have very high doses because you're trying to hit that tumor with as much drug product as possible, but you're, you know, you have to really examine all the data, my point is. Okay, and that's kind of the basic process. I mean, 3 to 5 minutes is not a lot of time to talk about this. I mean, we could actually probably have a whole course that would last a week long on this topic, but I'll turn it back over to the next speaker.
Yeah, thanks, Dean. We appreciate all the support that you give us on this, because this is a challenging subject area. Once we have the permitted daily exposure calculation, can either be from Afagility or from the client. We then at PCI, we summarize it in our own sort of short report, and we add it to our QMS system, and then that goes through our own round of review and approval. And that's just to allow us to have a consistent approach across all our products, so that we can always, when an audit comes through, we can always show how we process the PDE. Okay, so once we have the PDE approved by our quality, we then use it to calculate maximum allowable carryovers along with information that we need, such as the batch size and the maximum daily dose of the formulated product. And then once we have that maximum allowable carryover, we can then derive a swab limit based on the shared equipment surface area divided by the swab area. So that gives us then our swab limit. So that swab limit, we derive, it's one of the first things that we derive, and that allows our analytical team to have a target that they need to hit for their swab limit. So it's a very important part of any new product introduction. So the way we calculate that swab limit is that we, instead of using a worst case approach, where we say this is the smallest batch size that we can make on the equipment, we actually calculate the worst case swab limit for all the current products in our facility. This really helps us out, because if we took that worst case approach, we'd end up with a very low swab limit with all these high potent compounds that come through the facility. And we'd also have to update it very regularly, because in development, products are undergoing a lot of changes as they're being developed. Equipment trains are changing. So it's a lot easier for us to be able to deal with that if we calculate it, and we use the validated spreadsheet to do that. So this spreadsheet, it's sectioned off and anonymized, so we don't use the product names. So this spreadsheet, it has all the information for all the products in our facility. So it has all the batch sizes, it has all the PDEs, and then we select the equipment train for all these products. And using that information, it can then calculate all the swab limits, and it shows us which one is the worst case swab limit. So this is the information that we give to the analytical team, and that's what they know that they need to target. Okay. So that approach sort of allows us to be very flexible as well, because this spreadsheet, it shows us, you know, which products might be incompatible with the new products coming online. You know, it might show you, well, this is sharing a lot of surface area at the tablet press. So is there a different tablet press we can use so that we can control the equipment trains? So it's a very useful system for us. So having that worst case sort of scenario has shown to be very flexible for us. So yeah, if I then pass it back to the team.
Thanks, Gareth. So we have some questions from our text service, so I'm going to dish these out between the two of us here, or three of us, I should say. I can answer as well. But essentially, I think this one's for maybe for you, Dean. So the question is, does an ADE change based on the formulation?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Dave. And we get asked that question very frequently. And actually, we created a database of frequently asked questions, and that one comes up all the time. And the short answer is no. And you think about this. Risk equals hazard times probability of exposure or probability of occurrence. And the hazard is based solely on the toxicology of the compound, its inherent toxicology. The probability of occurrence or probability of an adverse event can be based on the formulation. So for example, a dry powder behaves much more poorly than a liquid, so that would be a probability of exposure factor. A formulation with a very small percentage of API is a less probability of occurrence than something that has 100% of the API in it, and then what kind of controls you have in place, all those are probably are probability factors. But again, the ADE, it is solely based on the inherent toxicology properties of the chemical. And think about it for a minute. Otherwise, you would have to have almost an infinite number of ADEs to manage for one compound. That would be very difficult to manage. So, I kind of like the definition of the ADE. It's day after day by any route. So you pick the most sensitive route to calculate your ADE, you're going to cover all the other routes. So that way it keeps you from having to manage, three or four different ADEs for the same compound.
Okay? So is this a different way of looking at it from, say, occupational exposure limits? So if at PCI, obviously, we formulate and manufacture drug products, which obviously the concentration of the final formulated product, densification and so forth, does have an effect on how an OEL can, it's not changing, but how it's actually processed through.
Okay. Yeah. If you're handling 100% of your API, such as a dispensing operation, your risk is quite high because you got 100% pure drug product. Now, when you get moved through the process and you get the formulation, you may have a very low percentage of drug in the final formulation. So your risk will go down, your risk of exposure will go down, even though the OEL or ADE stayed the same, because now you have a lot of excipients in, that are diluting it, so to speak. The risk of, for example, the risk of, during packaging is quite low compared to dispensing.
Yeah. Thanks, Dean. Right, we've got a question, I think, for Gareth. When you receive ADEs from clients, how do you respond when you have multiple ADEs from different sources? How do you evaluate which one to go with?
Yeah, this is a tricky question for us. It does change a lot, and I think Dean alluded to it in his talk, where he was saying that some people don't go into the depth of the guidelines. So you'll have some where they haven't taken things into account at all. So you end up with an inappropriately high PDE, which wouldn't be safe to use. And then you get the other end of the spectrum where you've got really cautious approaches to PDE calculations, where they're adding in modifying factors and you're ending up with a very low PDE. So I think sometimes we do sort of need assistance from a third party, and we do go to Affagility for their support to help us sort of understand. And sometimes the client is happier with that approach where, you know, this is a third party, this is an independent look at the data, and they're more likely to accept the judgment, I feel.
And Garrett, if I might add to that, you know, we've seen some very poor monographs, and that the entire monograph was like 1.5-2 pages long. That's not adequate. You know, you have to have it properly cited, properly documented. There's, you know, certain sections that are they want to see in every document. And I think our monographs typically are now at the low end of the scale, are probably about 18 pages long. And at the higher end of the, or the average is probably around 24 pages long. And everything's cited, you know, and explained very thoroughly. And that's what the expectations of the EMA inspectors are becoming. When the EMA guideline first came out, they were pretty lax or pretty lenient on companies, but now that they've gained more experience and started seeing a lot of more monographs written, now their expectations have gone up substantially to what they were in 2015.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question, and this one's just came in via the panel assessment there. So when asking for an ADE or OEL data on an API before onboarding it into our testing facility, we usually receive a worthless safety data sheet. I know that feeling. Currently, we have to defer to an API expert to go and find the data. What other routes are available to get this data? Is it only an API or industrial hygienist expert that we have to go to?
Well, I can, if you don't mind, I can answer that question. Safety data sheets are the worst source of information. We only use safety data sheets as the last resort, and we've seen many safety data sheets that are available on the internet that are flat wrong. We saw one company that had thousands of products where they had the exact same toxicology data for every product in their portfolio. That's because all they were doing was copying and pasting the same tox data from one template to the next. You know, that's almost criminal. You know, and if you looked at it and then looked at another product and say, how can you have the exact same toxicology data for all these products? That's not possible. So safety data sheets are a bad source. I mean, we have about 40 databases that we use, and we also look through significant amount of journal articles. And, you know, it gets kind of expensive when you have to start buying, you know, $35 to $65 journal articles, but that's the, if you want to play the game, that's what you got to do. And, you know, we have proprietary databases that we subscribe to, and, you know, it takes a significant amount of time. It's not easy, but, you know, that's what you got to do anymore. And that's what the expectations of the regulators are.
Thank you, Dean. And thanks, Dean and Gareth, for answering those questions and obviously providing the discussion points that we've had today. So I'm just going to close it right now. So I think key topics are ADEs or ADEs. It doesn't matter whereabouts in the process. The guidance that was provided by the EMA was really good, but it's quite complex. So we need to ensure that we have quality of data, quantity and quality of data, so experts can actually assess the point and the best suited point of departure to provide the best ADE or PDE. And then we have to take that through quite a complex system for ensuring that the maximum carryover is taken, and we identify all the componentries of the equipment train of the drug product process, and we have to ensure that we really do ensure that the carryover doesn't go from one equipment train onto another. So I'm just going to hand back to Brad now, just for the final comments.
Thanks, Dave, and thank you to our speakers today, who did a great job in highlighting all the considerations required when setting health-based cleaning limits within a multi-product CDMO. I know I learned more about the safety data sheets and I guess what they are and what they're not. So thank you for that. If we weren't able to address your question today, we will follow up with you directly. And just so you know, the audio to this chat will soon be available to download from the resources section of our website, pciservices.com. If you're interested in learning to listening to any of our past chats, you can find them all at our website here. And just before closing out, I'd like to share some of the chats we have coming up in the next few months. If you're interested in any of these chats, please visit our events page to register. A lot of exciting topics coming up over the summer. I just want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to welcoming you to future chats in the series, and we wish you a great rest of your day. Goodbye.